ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So we're going to be reading chapter 7 from the 10th canto, text 37. Just in case some of you were wondering why I started smiling halfway through chanting Jairada Madhava, it was because Nila Madhava's Madanga playing makes you want to keep chanting. I was just chanting and I had it all planned in my mind. Okay, I'm going to just chant it twice, each line and stuff. And then he started playing and it's just like I actually hit that. You just feel like keep chanting. It's wonderful. Thank you. Okay, so text 37. Saviksha Vishvam Sahasa Rajan Sanjata Vepatu Samilya Mriga Sasvakshi Netri Asit Savishmita Netri asit suvishmita Saviksha vishvam sahasa Rajan sangyatta vepatu Samilya mriga sabakshi Netri asit suvishmita Saviksha Vishvam Sahasa Rajan Sanjata Vepatu Samilya Mriga Sabakshi Netri Asit Suvishmita Vaishnavis. Mother Yasoda. Viksha, by seeing. Vishvam, the whole universe. Sahasa, suddenly within the mouth of her son. Rajan, O king, Maharaj Bricket. Sanjata Vepatu, whose heart was beating. Similya, opening. Mrigasava Akshi, like the eyes of a deer cub. Netre, her two eyes. Asit, became. Suvishmita, astonished. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. When Mother Yasoda saw the whole universe within the mouth of her child, her heart began to throb, and in astonishment she wanted to close her restless eyes. Purport. Because of her pure maternal love, Mother Yasoda thought that this wonderful child, playing so many tricks, must have had some disease. She did not appreciate the wonders shown by her child. Rather, she wanted to close her eyes. She was expecting another danger, and therefore her eyes became restless like those of a deer cub. This was all the arrangement of Yoga Maya. The relationship between Mother Yasoda and Krishna is one of pure maternal love. In that love, Mother Yasoda did not very much appreciate the display of the Supreme Personality of Godhead's opulences. At the beginning of this chapter, two extra verses sometimes appear. Evam bahuni karmani gopanam samsayositam nandasya gehi bhavride kurvan vishnu janardana. In this way, to chastise and kill the demons, the child Krishna demonstrated many activities in the house of Nanda Maharaj, and the inhabitants of Raj enjoyed those incidents. And then the next one. Evam sa vavride vishnur nanda geha janardana kurvan anisam anandam gopalanam sayositam. To increase the transcendental pleasure of the gopas and the gopis, Krishna, the killer of all demons, was thus raised by his father and mother, Nanda and Yasoda. Shripad, the Jayadvaj Tirtha, also adds another verse after the third verse in this chapter. Vishtare neha karunyat sarva papa pranasanam bhaktum arasi dharma gya dayalus tvam iti prabho. Bricket Maharaj then requested Sukadeva Goswami to continue speaking such narrations about the pastimes of Krishna so that the king could enjoy from them transcendental bliss. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 10th canto, 7th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Killing of the Demon of Trinavarta. Om Aginati Manandasha Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshurna Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurudevena Maha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Ganamayam Dadati Swapadantikam. So here in the 10th canto, we're hearing a lot about the ultimate perfection of life. In that, we're hearing about devotees who have achieved Swarup, or who are situated in their Swarup city. Swarup city means the perfection of one's constitutional position. They're liberated souls. Many of them are nichasiddha devotees. So we're hearing about the devotional service that's being experienced by devotees who are in one of those five rasas. There's Shantaras, Dasharas, Sakyaras, Vatsalyaras, and Madhuryaras. As mentioned here, Mother Yasoda's in Madhuryaras. No, sorry, Vatsalyaras. And so this is, very elevated platform. And Mother Yasoda, she wasn't, she's so much absorbed in this Vatsalya Ras, this exchanging of that personal relationship with Krishna as his mother, that it's a disturbance to her. She doesn't want to see the universal form. It's described here. What happens when she sees the universal form? She wanted to close her restless eyes. She didn't want to know about it. I don't want to know about any universal form. I just want to be Krishna's mother. I'm totally into just being the mother of this child, Krishna. And So at least in this is the first time this happened. It actually happens twice. The second time, Krishna doesn't let her get away with it so much. And as Krishna tries to force the issue a little bit more. Later on, a couple chapters forward, we're going to read about how Krishna's playing with his friends, and he was being called back by his mother to come for dinner or something. Nanda Maharaj was waiting. So he had to stop playing with them, and the friends got all upset because Krishna was just about to leave right at the height. You know, they're just really getting into things. And right at the height of all the playing, Krishna's telling him, I got to go, guys. And my mom's calling me, and got to go back. My dad's waiting for us to have dinner. And so they told his mother that he was eating dirt. Actually, was he eating dirt? No, he wasn't. Yeah, so they conspired against him. They conspired against him that he was, you know, they told his mother that Krishna's eating dirt because they wanted to get revenge on Krishna for, you know, dipping out on the play. So they told his mother, Mother Yasoda, Krishna's eating dirt, you know, to get him in trouble. So she said, oh my God, that's horrible. Why is my son eating dirt? We have all this wonderful sweetmeats and food and everything around the house here, you know, all this first class prasadam, and he's eating dirt. And so she confronted him. She thought, well, I got to give him the benefit of the doubt. I'm just going to confront him on this and ask him, why are you eating dirt? Krishna, why are you eating dirt? And so she did. And Krishna said, I'm not eating dirt. And she said, no, but these boys are saying you're eating dirt. And your brother Balaram is also, you know, among them. And he's saying you're eating dirt. And he explains to, and then Krishna explains to her, well, this is what's happened is I was playing and I had to leave to come back home and everything. And they're really upset with me and they're trying to, you know, get back at me like this. And she said, okay, well, anyway, there's one way to resolve this, you know, to open your mouth. And if you haven't been eating dirt, I'll see. If you've been eating dirt, I'll see. If you haven't, I'll see. So Krishna, okay. So he opened his mouth. And then once again, Mother Yasoda saw the universal form. And apparently the second time was a more powerful experience. She couldn't just shrug it off this time. The second time, she couldn't just shrug it off. It really hit her. And she started realizing, oh my God, who is this boy? Who is my son? And she was, you know, she was seeing the whole universal form, and it really changed her whole mentality this time. She actually came out, at least temporarily, momentarily, she came out of the Vatsalya Ras and started thinking, like, I'm thinking all these, you know, the people here are my servants, and this belongs to me. And you know, she came right out of the, she was, it's like an out of mind experience. You've heard of an out of body experience? She had like an out of mind. She was reflecting on her whole situation very philosophically, which was uncharacteristic for Mother Yasoda, who is just, you know, generally absorbed in being Krishna's mother. But here she was very philosophically considering the whole thing. And then Krishna kind of covered her over again, and she went back into the Vatsalya Ras. So, you know, this is the kind of exchange between Krishna and his confidential devotees experience. And there was an interesting, I'll just read, it's nicely explained how the whole thing works. There's a text in a purport further on where Prabhupada explains this, gives us some further insight into this. I'll read the text in purport. It says, Mother Yasoda, by the grace of the Lord, could understand the real truth. This is appears after the second experience. But then again, the Supreme Master, by the influence of the internal potency, Yoga Maya, the Supreme Master, of course, Krishna, inspired her to become absorbed in intense maternal affection for her son. In other words, him. Purport. Although Mother Yasoda understood the whole philosophy of life, at the next moment she was overwhelmed by affection for her son by the influence of Yoga Maya. Unless she took care of her son Krishna, she thought, how could he be protected? She could not think otherwise, and thus she forgot all her philosophical speculations. This forgetfulness is described by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur as being inspired by the influence of Yoga Maya. Materialistic persons are captivated by Mahamaya, whereas devotees, by the arrangement of the spiritual energy, are captivated by Yogamaya. So it's kind of like even higher than philosophically understanding her constitutional position was her being absorbed in that spontaneous, natural, pure, transcendental, loving affection for Krishna as the mother. Okay. So, and when she reverted back to that, So I think one significant point here is that this is, so we're hearing about, as I said, the ultimate perfection of life, Mother Yasoda, the cowherd boys. Later we'll hear about the gopis who are in the Madhurya Ras. And the point is that this is open to all of us. And this isn't like a closed club or anything like that. You know, this is open to all of us. It's open to all of us to not just hear about, and as Shripad Vijayadvaj Tirtha mentions here, that he says, Prakrit Maharaj then requested Sukadeva Goswami to continue speaking such narrations about the pastimes of Krishna so that the king could enjoy transcendental bliss. Because by hearing about these things, it's open for us to hear about them and experience transcendental bliss just by hearing about it. Is that famous verse in the Bhagavad Gita, Machchita, Matkata, Pranabudayantas, Parashparam, Katayantas, Chamam, Nicham, Tushanti, Charamanti, Chavat. The thoughts of my pure devotees dwell in me, their lives are surrendered unto me, and they derive great satisfaction and bliss, enlightening one another and conversing about me. So just hearing these topics and discussing them is, you know, something that can one, it's, you know, potentially a way to experience, enjoy transcendental bliss, as stated in that verse. But even beyond that, these things are there. These things, so these topics are there in the 10th canto for that purpose, so that the devotees can hear and chant about them, but also to let us know that we can actually, it's like coming attractions. You know, when they have a movie, I think they call it these days trailers, right? Trailer, coming attraction. It's just to let us know that, hey, this is what you got to look forward to if you, you know, do this process, if you surrender to this understanding, you know, this whole philosophy of life and really get into it, this is what you have to look forward to. You know, you have the, you have to look forward to being, you know, a friend of Krishna. You know, a servant of Krishna, a friend of Krishna, a parent of Krishna, a lover of Krishna, like that, and you know, and have this kind of reciprocation. So this is what the what is being offered, you know, by the by, you know, the Bhagavatam and, you know, the whole the Vedic experience. This opportunity to of Swarup City to perfect one's constitutional position. And even here in this lifetime, if one is super fortunate, but if not, in after leaving this body, experiencing, you know, this, and this is the ultimate perfection of life. It's the ultimate perfection of life. And one point that I'd like to make here, and then I'll go on about elaborating more about the ultimate perfection of life, is that Krishna didn't need, it, you know, Mother Yasoda went, looked in Krishna's mouth, but it's not like Krishna needed her to look in his mouth in order to show her the universal form. Krishna likes to do things in style. So he had it happen that way. But if you remember in the, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita, and twice, actually, twice Mother Yasoda looked in her mouth and saw the universal form. But later on in his pastimes, when Krishna showed Arjuna the universal form, he didn't have Arjuna look in his mouth. I don't remember reading that in the Bhagavad Gita, that Arjuna looked in Krishna's mouth and saw the universal form. So Krishna doesn't need to have somebody look in his mouth to show him the universal form. You know, or like there's Akura, he had some sort of a, well, how would you say it, a mystical experience. It's also described there in the Krishna book. And later on, the cowherd men of Vrindavan, they were all sitting together and speculating, who is this Krishna anyway? God, he really does some amazing things. And they were just kind of like going over his pastimes one after the other. And then afterwards, Krishna decided, you know, I don't want to keep him in suspense. And he gave them some like a vision of this, of the right vision of the spiritual and material worlds like that. So, yeah, Krishna can reveal himself in any you know, to anybody in any sort of circumstances. It's not dependent upon looking in his mouth. I mean, the real qualification is stated, once again, 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, Tesham sattva viyuktanam bhajatam pritipurvakam tadami buddhiyogamtam yenamam upayantite tesham eva anakampartam ahamajnanajam tamaha nasyami apabhavishto jnanadipena bhashvata. To those who are constantly devoted and worship me with love, I give them the intelligence by which they can come to me. Out of compassion for them, I, who am dwelling within their heart, destroy the shining lamp of knowledge, the darkness born of ignorance. So in other words, when somebody is, you know, surrenders, is submissive, and favorably engages in devotional service, that's the reward. That's the reciprocation. Krishna rewards that sincere soul with that understanding. You know, that's how it happens. You engage in devotional service like that, and you know, you're awarded that understanding of, or you're allowed to enter into these confidential relationships with Krishna like that. So it all starts, you know, this whole process starts, and actually the process is very nicely outlined by Rupa Goswami in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Ado Shraddha Tato Sadhu Sangha Tato Bhajana Kriya Anartana Vritti Sat Tato Nishta Tato Ruchi Shakti Bhava and Prema. You know, there's that nice verse there. It appears in one of Prabhupada's purports in the, I think it's the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where he outlines, you know, the process of devotional service begins with faith and then associating with devotees. So, but another way to kind of, you know, really saying the same thing but just in a different way, it begins with hearing, you know, submissive hearing, right? If we want to, what to speak of, like, enter into, you know, these topics or this understanding, even to get an intellectual understanding, one has to be prepared to hear submissively. There's that famous verse, I think it's in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's in the prayers of Lord Brahma. Gyane prayasam udapashyanamanta eva jivanti san mukadakam bhavadi avarta stane shtita srutikatam banu tanavan manobir ye prayasam ajita taistri. I can't remember the last. Feel of yeah. That one should, Lord Brahma is speaking, he says, you should give up speculation. It's not going to get you anyway. Give up the process of speculation about what is the absolute truth and just take to hearing submissively from a realized soul. That's his recommendation. And that's, you know, that's a very important thing. That's a very important thing that we have to, and I'm going to say a lot more about that now. Very important point. And I had two realizations about that just very recently. One was how important that is. Krishna gave me some practical realization. I was going for a walk with a devotee. He's not a devotee yet. Hopefully he'll become a devotee. He's a college student who came here and visited, much like Original. You know, he was here about a week ago. So we went for a walk. And I took him on this route I usually take out towards the Kenneth Hahn Park. And so we were walking down Lenawee, which is kind of like just before you get to cross over La Cienega to go to the park, and then I was going to turn to go up the hill, to go up to the Baldwin Hill lookout. And so I kind of turned, and then I just said, well, so you know what? Let's go back there. Because what was happening was I was looking, there's this building there. It's one of these historical trust buildings, and I noticed in the backyard of the building was like this old trailer. And then I looked a bit more closely, and it was like a big, like almost like a one-acre lot. Just nothing doing, just with the old trailer sitting there, and I thought, what's that all about, you know? So it got me thinking about real estate and lots and stuff. So anyway, I turned the corner, we're walking to go up the hill, and then I looked back. Then I climbed up the fence to look to see what was going on in there, and you know, I couldn't figure out what was going on. And then, but from that angle, I looked straight forward at another place, which was just like maybe 100 meters down from it, which was something, a place I've been looking at for 20 years. You know, I said, you know what, I forget his name now, but he was here about a week ago. And I said, come on, let's walk over there. So I walked over there with him, and I, you know, we got right at the fence there, and I said, you know, this place has been here for like, I've been checking this place out for 20 years, and I can't make heads of, I used to not be able to make heads or tails out of it. In other words, what it is, it's like this, it's like a 5-acre plot. It's almost as big as the property we have here in New Dwarka. You know, from going from Venice to where our buildings end and like that. It's about that size. And it's got what looks like was a garage there. It looks like another building kind of looks like a barn. It's kind of like India where you see things are half built and half breaking down at the same time. You know, something looked like a stable. And for 20 years I've been checking that place out and go, what the heck's going on? And it has like overgrown. It's not like landscaped. It's bushes and shrubs and they're all overgrown. And, you know, you kind of can sort of, through them, you can kind of sort of half see things. And I've been trying to figure out what's the story behind this property, but I haven't, you know, really come up with anything. So we were standing there at the fence there, and on this particular day, which was a couple of weeks ago, I was able to get much more of a vision because it's the shrubs were cut away and the bushes were kind of pulled away. So we were standing up there against the fence, looking, And then some guy, you know, one of the people who lived in the houses right behind me, he comes up and he goes, "Can I help you guys?" You know, I said, "Oh yeah." I could see he was kind of apprehensive. You know, he was just thinking, "Well, maybe this is a couple of crooks casing the joint. You know, getting ready, you know, figuring out how they're gonna go in there and vandalize it or whatever." You know, so I just explained to him. I said, "Look, I'm just looking. I live in the neighborhood. I've been walking back and, you know, this place for about 20 years. I told him I'm a Hare Krishna. I walk by here when I take a walk and chant. And I just kind of figured best thing, honesty is the best policy. So I'll just kind of, you know, be totally open." And he kind of believed me. You know, he relaxed. And I said, "So what's, do you know anything about this place?" And he said, "Oh yeah." He said, I know everything about this place." He said, because he was a neighbor. He said, "The guy who owns it is Jim so-and-so. And, you know, his dad bought it in 1949 for practically nothing. And, you know, he's lived there. He lives there now with his wife, and his mom lived there for a long time. They used to have animals all over the property, and people could come in and, you know, check it out. It's like a little hobby farm kind of thing." And you know, he just went on and on for about 5 minutes, and he was telling me all this stuff about the guy. So he has a house in Tehachapi. He spends a lot of time there. And now what's happened is he sold the place to developers, and they're going to come in and they're going to put like 5 really expensive developments there that are really set back from the road, that are going to be about $3.5 million each. And then there's going to be a 90 unit, like a nursing home facility. You know, so, you know, he was telling me all this. So I said, "Oh, okay. And, you know, that went on for about 5 minutes. And I was just, you know, submissively asking, "Oh, really? What about this? What about?" And he was telling, and I thought, and then we walked away. And I realized as I was walking away, and I said this to the fellow I was walking, I said, "You know what? I just learned more about that place in 5 minutes of hearing from somebody who, you know, knew the guy and had a confidential relationship with the guy, than I did in 20 years of speculating about what was going on there. You know, for 20 years, I've been thinking, what the heck is going on? What is that place all about? Who lives there? Does anybody live there? How is it that a 5-acre lot right in the middle of, you know, just all this developed area is just sitting there? Like, I mean, what's, you know, how is that possible? This is good. This is prime real estate. How, you know?" Now I understood. You know, now I knew. After I met a guy who had a, you know, confidential relationship with him, and boom, within 5 minutes, I understood the whole story. Actually, I knew a little bit already, because about a couple weeks before that, when I was walking the same spot, I saw somebody, the gate open, which was a rare thing, and a car drive out. And I was bold enough to go up to the car and say, "Hi, excuse me, do you know anything?" Well, I can't remember what the question I asked. It must have been something like, "Do you know who lives here?" And the guy was an older guy, and he said, "Oh, well, actually, I live here." I said, "Oh, really?" And he was in the car with some, like, businessman-looking people, you know. I figured that must have been the developers, you know, they kind of work in the deal or something like that. So I already had a bit of an idea. But the point remains that, you know, 20 years speculating, I couldn't figure out a thing about the place. But within 5 minutes of talking to the owner, 1 minute of talking to the owner, 5 minutes of talking to a neighbor, I kind of have a pretty, you know, good picture of what's going on. So in the same way, to understand about Krishna, the absolute truth, you could speculate, or, you know, God, you could speculate for the rest of your life. Actually, you could speculate for many lives. And I think there's verses that sort of say like that. I haven't memorized them, unfortunately. But you could, which one? Bahunam Jaminam Te, yeah. After many births and deaths, you could speculate for many, many lives. And really, unless you, you know, until you come to this point of being prepared to, okay, I can't figure it out, I got to hear submissively from somebody who knows, you know, you won't get anywhere. So this is a very important point that, you know, we have to be prepared to hear submissively. And then once you hear submissively, then act submissively on what you've heard. And then that's when it all starts happening. You know, that's when you start entering into the relationships with Krishna. It, you know, starts off with, as I said, you know, Shraddha, and then you, Ado Shraddha Tato Sadhu Sangha, you associate with the devotees, Sadhu Sangha Bhajana Kriya, you start practicing devotional service, you become free from, you know, lust, anger, greed, your anarthas, you become fixed in devotional service, and then as you know, you keep going, after Nishtha, there's Ruchi, and then a Shakti and Bhava and Prema. When you start getting into those, I was told that, I think it was in a class I heard it described, it's like if you're doing a bicycle, Shraddha, Bhajana Kriya, Anartha Navritti, it's kind of like piloting the bike uphill. And when you get to like around Nishta or Ruchi, it's like all of a sudden you're going, the bike's going downhill. It becomes, because you know, you got a taste, and those last stages become more quickly and easily. You're over the hard part once you get past Anartha Nivritti. But that's when you start entering into these relationships, you know, start understanding about your Swarup City. It starts gradually becoming revealed to you. And well, how are we doing for time? A little bit left? Okay, good. So the thing we want to do is we definitely want to hear submissively from a self-realized soul and then act upon that. And the thing we definitely don't want to do is have a challenging challenging attitude or critical, fault-finding attitude. That's the first, what I was just describing up till this point, is the best way to advance in devotional service, and the quickest way to cut your own throat, to hang yourself, is to be challenging and unsubmissive and critical and fault-finding. And there's, you know, a great, I can't remember if it was mentioned in the Archidist class, or just, I think it was just in the, afterwards I was talking to Virabhu Prabhu, and he's mentioned that to me. There was an incident that took place here in Los Angeles, right upstairs there, where two devotees, they went up to ask Prabhupada some questions. You know, they were fault-finding. I mean, they had some legitimate points, but their attitude was one of criticism, fault-finding. Even practically almost with Prabhupada, you know, definitely with what was going on in the movement, points in the philosophy, even, you know, that was their attitude. And Prabhupada became not really irritated with them, you know, to the point where he became indignant. They were asking, well, Prabhupada, you know, we're disturbed that the women are sent out and they have to, like, they're prostituting themselves to distribute the books and the brahmacharis. How come nobody sits down with the brahmacharis and helps them prepare for, because most of them are going to get married, so they should, you know, get some training so they could do something when they, you know, like this type of thing. And Prabhupada said, well, look, you know, you're not following, so you have no right. What's it to you, basically, he said in a polite way. What's it to you? You're not following, you know, the program. And then it went back and forth like that. But at one point, Prabhupada said, he actually told them, he said, so they said, so what is your advice? Oh, he said, but when we bring these points up to the managers, they don't listen to us. And Prabhupada said, so why are you worried? They don't have to listen to you. You just do your own duty, you know. And then, but they don't give us anything to do. And anyway, so they asked Prabhupada, what should we do? And Prabhupada said, work, make money, and enjoy. In other words, he could understand, you know, their attitude, and he was, you know, he basically was rejecting his disciples, you know, just on because of that, you know. And then, and it got, you know, just went from bad to worse throughout that thing. So, you know, I was with, actually, Vijay was up in my apartment last night, and we were reading that together, and we both could understand it. This is definitely the way to, you know, to ruin your spiritual life, to have that sort of an attitude. And, so no need to say much more about that. But so now we're entering into, coming towards the Prabhupada Marathon. And this is like a really great opportunity because, you know, Prabhupada said to be very quickly recognized by Krishna, preaching is the shortcut process. And, of course, there's many different ways one can preach. But certainly distributing Prabhupada's books is one of them. And, and it's a very important one of them. So this is a great opportunity because, this is, as we said earlier in the class, this is the way to, you know, just by pleasing, following the instructions of the spiritual master, pleasing the spiritual master, all these things will actually progress towards the ultimate perfection of life. This is the, you know, the great opportunity to progress towards what we're hearing about, you know, every day now as we're reading the 10th canto, to enter into these types of understandings. And it's practical. It's not, I'll explain it to you. And devotees who have done book distribution, they experience this sometimes on a regular daily basis. You know, you go out there and you try to perform the activity. And quite often it seems like difficult or even impossible at first or at times. And you just keep doing it. And then by amazing, somehow, by arrangements that you feel very confident are not under the auspices or the jurisdiction of the external energy, everything starts working. Like the people start taking books, people start becoming interested, people start taking books, giving nice donations, telling you things like, thank you so much for being here. And that's like, you know, right after like an hour or two of nobody showing any interest, everybody just kind of walking right by you and not caring less. And so, you know, it kind of just changes from one thing to, and you realize that this is the internal potency. This is Krishna reciprocating with my intention or my determination to surrender to this activity and, you know, try to please serve Prabhupada in this way. So, you know, Prabhupada actually was asked here, there was some devotees here, and this happened here in Los Angeles. Ramaswar Prabhu apparently at some point made the statement that this book distribution of Sankirtan is in the mood of the gopis. So there was devotees who got upset about that. They were concerned. Was that? That sounds like a little sahaja to them. You know, so they were kind of, so they asked Prabhupada. You know, but they asked Prabhupada in the mood of like, okay, you know, he's obviously over the top here, and Prabhupada's going to vindicate us by saying that's taking it a bit too far. But Prabhupada, the response came back from Prabhupada, yes, he's right. You know, it's in the mood of the gopis. In the sense that the gopis, what are they interested in doing? They're interested in not enjoying Krishna directly, but they take enjoyment by bringing other devotees in. You see? Like that. That's part of the mentality of the gopis. They want to, you know, push, or this person's pleasing Krishna, push that. They're more concerned about that, bringing other devotees in, you know, to get Krishna's association. So, and that's, of course, you know, the mood of book distribution of Sankirtan. So in this way, you know, by surrendering to the activity, we get a glimpse. And well, depending upon who you are and how much you've surrendered to it, you might be getting more than a glimpse. But it's an opportunity. You know, it's an opportunity that's being offered to us to enter into these higher understandings of you know bhakti yoga and experience these things. So I'll stop there. Does anybody have any question or comment? Yeah, two hands went up from the same person, so that means we got to answer this question.
Thank you so much for sharing this stuff. Whenever somebody finishes speaking, I just want to say thank you. People get their hands up first, so I just want to say thank you. Thank you. I love you. Thank you all for being here. All this stuff, it's amazing. Just thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
No, you're certainly welcome. Thank you for coming. Anybody else? Anything? Nila Madhava, we got one.
Thank you for a nice class, Prabhu. I appreciated your point about speculating about the lot for so many years, and then just asking somebody who knew. And that rung a bell. I was hearing Vaisheshika Prabhu was saying that the jnanis who go about trying to understand Krishna by speculation are like the, you know, the government agents digging through the trash and trying to read your these receipts to try and figure, instead of just coming directly. And you know,
what was that thing about going through the trash? Was it?
So like, there's two ways to get to know somebody. One is if you serve them and you come with a non-envious direct approach that I'm here to serve you, and then that invokes the trust of Krishna and he reveals himself to you, versus going around the back way and trying to rely on your own intellect, trying to, with kind of a envious attitude of Krishna and relying on your own intellect to try and figure it out, is like, you know, maybe like government agents, they might not know
you
personally, but they're rummaging through the trash and like trying to piece things together in the room and, you know, trying to figure
it out. That's a good analogy. Thank you. Prema Sankirtan, and then we'll stop.
I'm just following his questions and your statement about speculation. How is speculation manifest in a devotee's life? You know, we are not pure devotees, so...
How is it manifest in devotee's life?
You know, jnana and karma and especially speculation. You know, you want to know about Krishna more and more and more, but something keeps you. That means you can say you speculate. You don't want to surrender to those lilas. You don't want to read about them. So you can call that also speculation. But can you say a little bit more about it?
Well, speculation is anything other than accepting the knowledge we're receiving from the Guru Parampara. Then you're speculating. You know, Prabhupada's given us the books. He himself said, whatever knowledge I have, I've given in the books. That's it. He told those devotees that, upstairs like that. So we're speculating if we're going to outside sources, you know, to that degree, you know. Basically, I mean, to the degree that we're going to outside sources, especially, if, you know, thinking that we need something other than what Prabhupada gave us to understand about the absolute truth of Krishna, to that degree we're speculating. We should just stick to the parampara. Nothing else is required. Maybe for preaching, you know, for bridge preaching, if it's at your service and you're expert, you can take things to, you know, there is that verse in the first canto which says, "Oh, good soul, does not a thing apply therapeutically cure a disease which was caused by the very same thing?" So if somebody's preaching, like Judah Karma wrote that book, Human Devolution. So he took things from, you know, the ordinary world, but he used those as examples to support, you know, the Siddhanta of the Brahma Mava Gaudiya Sampradaya. So that's okay. But he wasn't like he was looking to that to try to understand. No, he already understands, and he just, for the benefit of people who aren't already devotees, he was making use of stuff that they place some faith in and importance to convince them of our conclusion. So it's justifiable in that circumstance, in that sense, but for our own edification, we don't need to, you know, take shelter of anything other than information that's coming through us through Prabhupada and the Guru Parampara. Okay, thank you very much. Grantarach Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Thank you.